things like militant feminism. It's irrational. These women are angry at something has happened to them in their lives. And their rage and anger, they take it out now on the country or on all men, or men in the powerful majority, which are white Christian men and so forth.
When I first began DJing, one of the earliest things that I struggled with was playing the artist, well, playing music by a particular artist, because I wasn't sure how it was going to be received. And so I made the choice really early on that I was not just automatically going to include that particular artist's in any of my mixes, in any of my playlists. And I decided to not do so because said artist is a well-known pedophile, and not with just one victim or two victims. I'm fairly certain at this point you would run out of hands. Well, the average person would run out of hands and fingers counting how many people, how many children have been victimized by this particular artist. And so I said, okay, I am not going to play their music. If somebody asks me to play it, it's a little different. I work for them. I will go ahead and play it at that point. Otherwise, I'm not going to just automatically do it. And I thought, first of all, that no one would ask for it. And then if somebody did, there's going to be an uproar. It's going to be a problem because other people are going to realize, oh man, he's playing that pedophile's soundtrack. To my surprise and a slight degree of shock, I ended up getting a ton of requests for that artist. And I began playing that artist at just about every single event that I DJed for, whether it was a birthday party or a wedding, or just a celebration in general, the opening of a this, that, or the other. Just this song was just, there were a few songs, but there was one song in particular. And I said, man, maybe people don't know. Maybe somewhere along the way they missed that this guy is a freaking pedophile. And it's not like he's secretly a pedophile as like, I'm on the dark web and I found out through the dark web because there's photos and videos of him on the dark web with... No. It's a very well-known, well-publicized fact. Everybody knows that he's a pedophile. That's the worst part. You know, he also just abuses women in general. He was accused of keeping sex slaves in his home. As if pedophilia wasn't bad enough, he's got other women, full-grown women, chained up in his basement where he goes down there and just has sex with them whenever he feels like it. And they maybe were at one time willing participants, but they're not anymore. Yeah, this artist just gets worse and worse and worse. And I've known about this for about 20-some years now. It's the mid-90s when I first realized what this person was doing. And I ended up not ever getting into their music. I'm going to go ahead and pull back the curtain now. The artist that I'm obviously referring to is R. Kelly. And I always wondered how this was not a problem. And the song that everybody seems to ask for is the track is known as the Remix to Ignition. And I still get asked for it just about every single time I go out. But something happened recently. The rest of the world seems to have gotten on board to where I've been. You know, and I'm going to play High and Mighty for a moment, but I'll knock myself off my own pedestal. Just give me a second. There's a show, and I haven't seen the show right now. I've been reading a lot about it. But there's a show called Surviving R. Kelly, and it's a show where they give voice to a whole bunch of his victims. Now, R. Kelly has never waned in popularity, and the amount of big-name artists that were willing to do songs with him are far and wide. But now that it's in a TV show, nobody wants to be associated with him anymore. Chance the Rapper, Lady Gaga, every one of them has asked that they, you know, don't play our songs on the radio, don't play them on YouTube, they want them taken down. We'd like them taken down off of Spotify. We don't want to be associated with this artist anymore. Because now, hold on, this is not new. It's not news, as they say. R. Kelly married Aaliyah when she was 14 years old back in, if I'm not mistaken, 1993 or 1990, 14 years old, married. And everybody knew. And then, of course, in the early aughts, he got busted because he decided to take video of himself urinating on underage girls. And then those tapes, this is not a secret. But now that it's in a TV show, now everybody is painfully aware of it and all of a sudden doesn't want to be associated with him anymore. There was another case, The Making of a Murderer was on Netflix. It was gigantic for a little while. And because of what was put in that TV show, it reopened that case, SeaWorld. With respect to SeaWorld, they don't use orcas anymore. They don't use killer whales. Why? Because there was a documentary called Blackfish that documented the abuse that those whales go through, the hell that their lives are, even with the way SeaWorld tried to treat. And so all of these changes brought on by the freaking TV shows. There's a ton of information out there about really all of these things. When I hear conspiracy theorists talk, I just can't help but think of how effing nuts they are. I said there's a lot of things, there's a lot of good information out there, things that you should honestly be outraged about. And the fact that you're outraged about something that you made up in your head is insane to me. Somehow people miss all of these gigantic stories that are just staring at us in the face. The fact that R. Kelly got away with being a pedophile in public for over 20 years, everybody just sort of turned a blind eye to it, but now it's on a TV show and now everybody's... So is that the best way to get information? Do we have to start putting important stories into TV shows that you can stream in your home whenever you feel like streaming them? And maybe that's when you'll be able to take in the information. Obviously, frustrating to me because I am in love with a dying platform, with a dying medium, and that's radio. And then to a lesser extent, podcasts. They're a dying thing. You know, they're good on road trips, but otherwise nobody's really going to sit around and listen to them. And I'm aware of that fact now. You know, people do take them in. But even then, there's quite a few of them that you can take in on YouTube. And it's not like there's movies, but there might be images that go along with it too. Because for whatever reason, we're unable to just sit and listen, use theater of the mind, and absorb information in this way. Back to the R. Kelly thing. So there's an article written over at the website Pitchfork by Jason Green. And the headline is, How Do We Live With Music Made by Problematic Artists? I just want to give you a few highlights from it. Quoting here, right now I have an abuser's song stuck in my head. And it feels like a bit of a violation, the presence of this song and everything that it brings with it. But the fault is all mine. I opened the door, invited the song in, and showed it around. I had all the warnings you would need, but the song was there on my phone screen. All I had to do was touch it, so I did. And then, just like that, the song took up residence in me, and now it follows me around. By now, most music listeners know this experience. The song suddenly hurts to hear. The sweet voice in our head turns sour. A song that pleased us now haunts us. Everyone's fulcrum is different, set off by their own experience. But the effect is the same. Something you thought you knew about an artist, or something you knew without fundamentally acknowledging, explodes from the periphery into full view. Suddenly, the uneasy space you maintained between the sounds an artist made and the life that they lived crumples forever. And finally, most of us don't know what to do when this happens, but we fervently pretend that we do. We flood social media channels with our late-breaking outrage. We declare this artist canceled. Some of us hug the artist closer, taking it upon ourselves to defend them from perceived attacks, even if this means stepping around obvious facts about their behavior, like shattered glass. In the past 2 years, as the cultural flames around artists and their art have burned hotter, our reactions to transgressions have grown increasingly convulsive. Leaving aside for a moment the question of what society does with the people, questions of restorative justice and justice for survivors, the virtues of deplatforming, or a million other debates that slip far outside the private arena of headphones. Where does this music go once it has entered into our lives? It doesn't simply leave us. it can't. Whether it's Triple X Tentacion, the late rapper who was charged with domestic battery and assault, or R. Kelly, who was tried and acquitted on child pornography charges in 2008 and has been accused of soliciting sex from minors and keeping women in his home against their will. So this is where I have to admit that I fall short. Triple X Tentacion. So here's the bad thing. Triple X Tentacion grew up less than privileged, for certain. And he got into hip hop and he had a fair amount of unchecked rage. He was an absolute emotional roller coaster. He took that and he put it into music. But the bad part is that's not where it stopped. When you listen to his music, you hear high highs, low lows, and all the anger and rage and hate and love in between. It's some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard in my life. But shortly before he was murdered, early in 2018, he beat the hell out of his pregnant girlfriend so bad that he caved in one of her eyes. She's now half blind. His pregnant girlfriend. Not to leave it alone there, he then went on to mention it in a song. That he did it, that she pissed him off, and that she had it coming. There is the bad news, and that's a really hard thing to face. So right away, once I learned that, because I love this guy's music, I own it, I've used it as a DJ, I listen to it on my own personal time, I love it, and I can't get around it, and I said, that's fine. I'm just going to find a way to separate myself. The artist is separate from the music. But everything I've read and everything that I've seen since I tried to make that conscious decision, well, everything else has sort of pointed otherwise, that you can't really separate them, or at least not separate them with any great degree of success. I feel like because I've faced it and I said it's a terrible, terrible thing that he did, I should probably stop listening to his music. But like any good addict, I am addicted. And I'm not just addicted to this song or this artist, or I'm addicted to music as a whole. It's the thing that takes up more time and space in my life than anything else. Even in the studio that I am in right now, I've got a stack of vinyl right by my left foot, and 4,000 CDs, 4,000 physical CDs surrounding me, as well as laptops, hard drives, and everything else that you can store music on. I'm an absolute effing addict when it comes to this stuff, and it's really tough for me. So when the R. Kelly thing happened, I obviously, I knew, I told you all. But then I had to check myself, because I, too, have an artist that has that kind of a problem, or worse. And it'd be nice to say, well, at least he's not a pedophile, but what he did is no less unforgivable. Quoting here from the article again, most of us managed to avoid thinking about our music as a consumer good, at least most of the time. Part of this has to do with the nature of internet commerce, which has proven extremely adept at sanding away friction points until your purchasing decisions have all of the forethought of a sneeze. Spotify, Apple, Amazon move mountains to ease consumption, and they do it so effectively that it's frighteningly easy to pretend that this friction, carbon footprints, packed warehouses, unprecedented monopoly, pick your late capitalist poison, ever existed. But music in particular has the trickiest relationship to commerce. Amazon may have eroded the value of a book, but ebooks didn't completely replace physical ones. The music industry, meanwhile, never quite convinced listeners that stealing digital music was harmful, so they abandoned the sale of discrete units and remodeled themselves around streaming, a model that looked and felt exactly like the stealing customers were already doing. In other words, they removed ownership entirely. We rent our music now, and then give it back to the cloud when we are done. So why is that a problem when it comes to these troublesome artists? Music listening has always been private, but in another era, you might have had to venture outside to procure it. 20 years ago, if you wanted to buy music made by a known abuser at a store, you would have to risk some hot, focused shame. Streaming, meanwhile, with its blend of radio dial and kitchen faucet, removes shame from the equation. You touch a song title and it starts playing for you and only you. Turn off sharing features on Spotify and you are free to move about the cultural infinitude in silence without fear of judgment. As a result, the gap between streaming an artist and purchasing their music directly feels enormous. It's the difference between liking a political candidate's post on Facebook and knocking on someone's door to canvass for them. This makes the insolubility of the art versus artist problem even more difficult in music. When you choose to expose yourself to the songs of an abuser, you're also subjecting yourself to a sustained whisper campaign for their inherent virtuousness. For the empathy, the tortured humanity lying within them. Seeing humanity in all humans, even murderers and abusers, can be powerful in a clear-eyed practice. It might be what some have called radical empathy. It may even be music's highest function if we allow it to happen, permitting the existence of beauty within deep ugliness, persuading us to remember that all humans share the mystic and strange impulse to make music or to partake in it, and yet passively accepting abusers' songs about themselves when their victims are giving no voice at all, and more, when their victims usually disappear into the cracks of society, often hounded by death threats from the artist's massive fan base, might also be a form of enabling or even empowering toxic behavior. We cast votes for artists with the invisible flow of our attention spans, and their implications are nearly impossible to track. Deciding where to draw or redraw lines is always messy. It is murky right up until the point it suddenly seems crystal clear and undeniable. The thing about XXX Tentacion is, yeah, in death, he has only grown ever more popular. And I see high school kids wearing the sweatshirts and the hats with his name and his image. And my hope is that maybe they don't know. And that's why they're still promoting it. Maybe. Or maybe they do know. And in their mind, they've justified it, justified why it's okay, maybe for this particular artist, because, of course, they are so into his music that they can't be without it. I don't know if there are any parents that listen to this program, but if there are, and I doubt your kids are listening to R. Kelly, that's more banging music. Well, sex music, sorry. But if they listen to XXX Tentacion, or really any of these other artists that have been accused of horrible, horrible things. I understand this happens in the NFL too, but for some reason, a lot of folks are uncomfortable with having that conversation. Just talk with them about it. Just let them know sort of the gravity of the situation when they let artists like this into their head, what it could do for them. Now, it might not do anything. I'm painfully aware of the terrible things that he's done, and I've tried to separate the man from the art, but I'm also not stupid when it comes to this stuff. As a result, finding ethical ways to consume music is confounding. In the end, aesthetics and morality simply don't talk to each other. One can spoil the other the way acid curdles milk, but music makes a terrible container for ethics. It leaks, it loses specific meaning. It can be conscripted by anyone to mean anything. The only thing we can be certain of is that this will happen again. 2 years from now, or 2 weeks from now, or in 2 hours, we will learn that we are in an intimate relationship with a piece of music made by someone who has done or said things that we cannot abide. Once that happens, we will again feel the panic of implication or disorientation. We can take arbitrary actions if they make us feel better. We can choose not to play their music anymore. We can decry their actions for friends and family, but the music itself will not stop whispering to us. We officially live inside of the Me Too era, and the Me Too era does not mean that these things are now happening. It means that these things have always been happening. They're happening right now, but they've always been happening. We've just finally decided as a culture that we are going to start taking notice of them. One of the other things I became painfully aware of, with this sort of apropos to what we're talking about, was the fact that in this country, and for the last decade or so, as laws have been loosened for what kind of folks are allowed to get visas to come into the country. By the way, I understand that the government's closed down and everyone's freaked out about what's going on the border. But the real problem with immigration is not the folks that are getting away from gang violence on the border. It's the folks that overstay their visas. And there are any number of folks that are coming into the country on, by the way, on visas, overstaying them. And overstaying them with terrible intentions. And sometimes those intentions are realized with the help of an American. There's an article in the AP, and I might cover this in more long form in the future. I just got done reading it, so I haven't been able to put together any sort of a show or a segment around it yet. But child brides, Americans applying to bring their child brides into America is a thing that's happening right now. Child brides into America. Now, depending on what state you live in, you might not be able to marry them till they're 16 or till they're 18, but whoa, whoa, whoa. Why is this even happening at all? Think about how long all of us just sat around and accepted the fact that we were enabling a pedophile by buying his music, by going to his concerts, by wearing his crap, his hats and his t-shirts and belts and whatever the hell else he makes. And then I just wonder, is there just a gigantic underbelly in America that gets very little attention, where it's not just a few pervs like the guy down the street that never comes out of his house? Maybe there's an entire movement of this thing. Maybe there's a whole lot of people that are into this, where child brides is okay, where child porn is okay. You know, where a 49-year-old man bringing a 15-year-old girl into this country for the purposes of marrying her and having sex with her is a thing, and it's legal. I just wonder how many people are doing this? How many people are cool with this? Shortly after we got the internet, one of the first things people did with it was they filled it with porn. But you can't, child porn is illegal in America, but it's not in a lot of other countries. So then you get what's referred to as the dark web. One of the most famous things that you can find on the dark web is child porn. You don't have to convince me, and I feel fairly certain that I don't have to convince you, but who are these people that think that it's okay to abuse children? So when it comes to these artists, I suppose you're just going to have to make your own determination about how you're going to have to deal with that. But for the rest of us, whether you're in a complicated relationship, musically or otherwise, with a troubled artist, I think we all need to become more conscious of the fact of the way that we are treating children, the way that we are viewing children, the way that we are using children. I hear so often from the older generation that this is what's wrong with kids today. This is what's wrong with this generation. Here's where things went wrong, and here's why things were so much better when they were kids. And I don't think that's right. Things change, times change, the culture changes. But if you really want to change the future, you really want the future to be better, you really want a future that you can be proud of, you start with the children, and you start by not hurting them. Then you move on to nurturing them. Then you love them, you care for them, you raise them. And that is what's going to make the future better.
this republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights, among them the right of free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. We have come to a clearer realization of the fact, however, that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry, people who are out of a job, are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industry, or shops, or farms, or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of farmers to raise and sell their products at a return which will give them and their families a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age and sickness and accident and unemployment. Finally, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for all our citizens. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
So this week marks the 75th anniversary of what FDR referred to as the Second Bill of Rights. The obvious idea there was the First Bill of Rights, the one that we still somewhat enjoy, should come with something a little bit more. I say it a lot on the show, as he said there in the clip, that a necessitous man is not a free man. If you are sick, you are not free. If you are hungry, you are not free. So on and so forth. If you don't have health care. So his idea was that we, that all of us would enjoy this very basic Bill of Rights, something similar to what they enjoy now in the Nordic countries, where access to health care is guaranteed and access to housing guaranteed and food and all the rest and just all the things that we need in order to be happy, in order to be healthy. Somewhere along the way, we got this idea, and I blame libertarians, that freedom comes from not having those things, or what libertarians like to refer to as choice. It is your choice, right? We have all these healthcare companies, and you get a choice. We got all these, you know, so on and so forth. And you get a choice, and you get a choice. And that's not really the way it worked out. What we end up with, where competition usually lowers prices, is we end up with just a handful of companies. And then that handful of companies ends up colluding, and then we all end up with nothing. Now, even though she is not president, and I'm going to say her name once because it's a mouthful, from here on out, I'm simply going to refer to her, as many folks do, as AOC, Alexandria, or Ocasio-Cortez. See, I said it once, and I still almost screwed it up. She's a first-time congresswoman from the Bronx. She has yet to vote on anything except for Speaker of the House. When she does this interview, of course, she's voted along with all the other Democrats a couple of times now to reopen the government, which has still not happened, which means it's clearly the Democrats' fault. I don't understand that. But even though she just got there and she served all of about a week and a half at this point, she is all the rage on the right. There are websites, there are blogs, there are Facebook pages, there are Twitter pages, there's just everything. just doing the best they can to destroy her. And why do they want AOC destroyed? Even though she is not the president, she is almost certainly, at least she appears, to be the second coming of FDR. So I went ahead, and for those of you that didn't want to listen, who haven't listened to the interview, don't want to listen to the interview, I went ahead and I pulled a couple of clips. And the second Bill of Rights that FDR had proposed, which never ever came to pass, and that's how long we've been trying to get people food and housing and health care for this long, and fair wages, right? His idea was that you work, one person in your household works a job that pays for everybody to survive. And it pays enough money for you to eat, to have at least one vehicle, to be able to afford your mortgage so that you can eventually own a house. And of course, it goes towards your net worth, and you're able to take at least one vacation a year. Just all these basic things for people that are willing to work. That's how long we've been working on those things. And that's how long conservatives have been working against us having those things. So FDR called it the second Bill of Rights, what the Democrats refer to it now as the new Green Deal.
You're talking about zero carbon emissions, no use of fossil fuels within 12 years?
That is the goal. It's ambitious. And
how is that possible? You're talking about everybody having to drive an electric car?
It's going to require a lot of rapid change that we don't even conceive as possible right now. What is the problem with trying to push our technological capacities to the furthest extent possible?
This would require, though, raising taxes.
There's an element where, yeah, there people are going to have to start paying their fair share in taxes.
Do you have a specific on the tax rate?
You know, you look at our tax rates back in the 60s, and when you have a progressive tax rate system, your tax rate, you know, let's say from zero to $75,000 may be 10% or 15%, et cetera. But once you get to like the tippy tops, on your 10 millionth dollar, sometimes you see tax rates as high as 60 or 70%. That doesn't mean all $10 million are taxed at an extremely high rate, but it means that as you climb up this ladder, you should be contributing more.
So the new Green Deal does a couple of things. First of all, it gets us off of oil, gets the money out of those industries that control them. I was watching a movie recently on Netflix called How It Will All End, and It was a bomb that landed in the United States, obviously all fictional. And the one thing that people fought over that was striking to me was fuel, because they couldn't move their cars around, obviously, without fuel. And I go, yeah, there's a very tight industry. I mean, our cars, our trucks, our planes, like everything runs, our everything runs on it. And there's a small group of folks that have a stranglehold on that particular energy, which means our food, our medicine, our clothing, our housing, everything is based on this one thing that we have no control over. So with the Green New Deal, obviously we would get energy from water, we'd get energy from the sun, we'd get energy from wind, and we would end the stranglehold. And the other thing that it would do is it would create tons and tons of jobs, more money to working people. Really, really good jobs, all these new positions, because to implement this will create a ton of jobs. Right now, we've got just these nasty, dirty oil jobs. And this would create good jobs that would provide that better pay and that better way of life. And it would clean up the damn air, and it would clean up the damn water, just really basic things. And they said, AOC, God, you're such a radical. That's the word, right? You can't do this. This is outside of the box thinking, or whatever slogan you want to use. This is so radical.
What you are talking about, just big picture, is a radical agenda compared to the way politics is done right now.
Well, I think that it only has ever been radicals that have changed this country. Abraham Lincoln made the radical decision to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made the radical decision to embark on establishing programs like Social Security.
Do you call yourself a radical?
Yeah, you know, if that's what radical means, call me a radical.
Hell yeah, Melvin's a radical. I don't like the way that we've been doing things, and you really shouldn't either. The fact that there are so many people that have so little and so few that have so much, the old saying that that MLK would say is, there's a, was it MLK or Gandhi, forgive me, there's enough to fill everyone's need, but there's not enough to fill everyone's greed. And the way AOC got to this particular petition was the old shoe leather. You know, she ran for it. She went door to door. She campaigned her arse off. And she did all of it while she was working a blue-collar job. Just working behind the counter. She was a bartender. And she talks about this. And I think this is one of those things that makes her, A, more relatable, and also introduces the idea of disintermediation. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, I just said that word. Disintermediation. So what is that? That's an economic term. Investopedia, a site that I spend way too much time on, defines it as, in finance, because it's an economic term, it's the withdrawal of funds from an intermediary financial institution, such as a bank or savings or loan association, to invest them directly. Essentially meaning you just get rid of the middleman. Disintermediation can occur when a wholesale purchase allows an interested buyer to purchase goods, sometimes at quantity, directly from the producer. This result can result in lower prices for the buyer because the intermediary, traditional retail store, has been removed from the process. So people feel like they are too far away from government. They feel like they don't have any power. They feel like they are not a part of the process. And what I think the AOC does by fulfilling this position, by going from a bartender to running for office, to winning, to getting to the House, to becoming so powerful and getting so much attention, I think what that does is that illustrates disintermediation. What she did by fighting for it and winning shows us that, hey, that we can do it too. It's the ultimate in disintermediation.
She was working as a waitress and bartender at the time. Like many members of her generation, she says she had student loans to pay and no health insurance.
I really understood the frustration that working people had across the political spectrum. You know, when anybody is saying the economy is going great, we are at record levels, there's a frustration that says, well, the economy's good for who?
I mean, unemployment is at record lows.
I don't think that tells the whole story. When you can't provide for your kids working a full-time job, working two full-time jobs, when you can't have health care, that is not dignified.
And as she's saying this, and Anderson Cooper decides to bring out the old term, the old scare term. What's the old scare term that they use when government works only for the super duper rich? That's just the way it is. But when it begins to work for us, the regular working people, you know, the people that she was sent there to represent, when it begins, they hear us and they take our concerns to the floor, which, by the way, they're all supposed to do, when they're fight for our concerns. When that happens, that is the four-letter word known as socialism.
When people hear the word socialism, they think Soviet Union, Cuba, Venezuela. Is that what you have in mind?
Of course not. Well, we have in mind, and my policies most closely resemble what we see in the UK, in Norway, in Finland, in Sweden.
How are you going to pay for all of this?
No one asks how we're going to pay for this Space Force. No one asked how we paid for a $2 trillion tax cut. Oh. We only ask how we pay for it on issues of housing, healthcare, and education. How do we pay for it? With the same exact mechanisms that we pay for military increases, for the Space Force, for all of these ambitious policies.
Goddamn right. Girlfriend tells no lies. We only ask how we're going to pay for it when it comes to healthcare and education, these things that help you and I. That's the only time we ask how we're going to pay for it. Because otherwise, we know exactly where the money's coming from. And I think the progressives need to come up with a different... Now, she identifies as a democratic socialist. And I can hear you now. Oh, my God. Socialism! It's not socialism. Democratic socialism and socialism are not the same thing. As a democratic socialist, that means the commons, the things that we all enjoy, the things we all... So that would be healthcare, that would be the military. The military socialized, funny. They don't mind giving all kinds of money to that socialist organization. But the commons, the roads, the bridges, the streets, the police, I mean, these things all belong to us. But then when it comes to manufacturing, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, jeans, cars, that kind of stuff goes to that stuff goes to the market. And then the market competes. They compete for our business. And it's not just one company that produces everything. It's lots of companies. And then that helps bring down prices and so on and so forth. Boom. Pretty simple stuff. But if it helps us, my God, socialism! And then there's the Democrats.
There are Democrats, obviously, who are worried about your effect on the party. Democratic Senator Chris Coons said about left-leaning Democrats, if the next 2 years is just a race to offer increasingly unrealistic proposals, it'll be difficult for us to make a credible case we should be allowed to govern again.
What makes it unrealistic?
How to pay for it.
We pay more per capita in healthcare and education for lower outcomes than many other nations. And so for me, what's unrealistic is what we're living in right now.
What makes it unrealistic? What makes it unrealistic is that it's going to work for us, regular working people. That's the thing that makes it unrealistic. And I'm glad she did. So when they can't get her on how to pay for it, which, hey, we don't, the military, I read a headline a couple of years ago in the headline. And it actually said, and I can't remember if it was Forbes or it was Bloomberg, and it actually said, the military has more money than they know what to do with. Now, forgive me, I have never read a headline that said, public schools have more money than they know what to do with. Homeless shelters have more money than they know what to do with. Housing assistance has more money than it knows what to. I've never, ever read those headlines. And there's a reason why. Yeah. The gigantic socialist organization known as the United States military has no problem taking all that money. When they spend it there, it's fine because obviously so much of it ends up in private hands. The richest zip code in America is not in Beverly Hills. It's in Virginia because that is where all of the military contractors live. So when they can't get her on the facts, then they go after the semantics.
One of the criticisms of you is that your math is fuzzy. The Washington Post recently awarded you four Pinocchios.
Oh my goodness.
For misstating some statistics about Pentagon spending.
If people want to really blow up one figure here or one word there, I would argue that they're missing the forest for the trees. I think that there's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right.
But being factually correct is important.
It's absolutely important. And whenever I make a mistake, I say, okay, this was clumsy. And then I restate what my point was. But it's not the same thing as the president lying about immigrants. It's not the same thing at all.
So I don't know if you've had a chance to hear any of these clips prior to me playing them. But my first exposure, and I listen to 60 Minutes a lot. I don't watch TV, so I listen to podcasts when I do absorb it. But when I haven't listened recently, but I would hear her clips played back on Fox and on MSNBC and CBS. I'd hear the clips from this interview played back. It's none of the stuff that I'm playing for you now. And it might be part of the stuff I'm playing for you now, which I know I should make shorter audio clips, but I want you to get the full context. And that's why I make them long. Because if you shorten them up, you can make them say anything. I can really make anybody say anything through studio magic. And I don't like to do that. So when I was listening to the clips that they were playing, I said, that's not a real good representative of what she's really trying to say. So I went through the whole interview myself, and it's a 15-minute interview. It took me hours to make the damn clips. Fine. But I wanted to bring it to you exactly as it is. Okay. Here's what she said. Here's a little bit of commentary. But girlfriend's just knocking it out of the damn park. And then she got super radical. Are you ready for this? She was asked. She decided. And then she answered honestly. So the question, yo, is the president a racist? Yes. Whoa. You didn't even stop. Think about it. You want to stop and think about that? No, he's a racist. Oh, my God. She is such a radical.
You don't talk about President Trump very much.
No.
Why?
No. Because I think he's a symptom of a problem.
What do you mean?
The president certainly didn't invent racism, but he's certainly given a voice to it and expanded it and created a platform for those things.
Do you believe President Trump is a racist?
Yeah. Yeah. No question.
How can you say that?
When you look at the words that he uses, which are historic dog whistles of white supremacy, when you look at how he reacted to the Charlottesville incident where neo-Nazis murdered a woman versus how he manufactures crises like immigrants seeking legal refuge on our borders, it's night and day.
I started this segment by talking about how freaked out conservatives are by her, and they're having trouble punching holes in her arguments. They're having trouble getting her on semantics. They're having trouble getting her on facts. Facts are a pesky thing. When you are a libertarian, or you are one of these new Trump-type conservatives, and so what they try to get her on is the whole millionaire, billionaire thing, because there's clearly none of those, Shelley Adelson, the Koch brothers, Steve Wynn. There's clearly none of those billionaires giving money to the United States Republican Party. They're only giving money, clearly, to the United States Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party obviously has its problems with money. So she was walking through the halls of Congress, and some dopey conservative decided to take a picture of her from behind and noted that her suit, the suit that she was wearing, the skirt suit, I forget what it's called. Look at that skirt suit or whatever the hell it's called. She does not look like she's struggling. So here's the thing. If you're going to show up in Washington, D.C., and you're going to fight for working people, you had better show up, in rags and tatters. Because if you do not, you are... Clearly a millionaire. Clearly Melvin is a millionaire. And so she addresses it, but she doesn't just address it from that point. She also points out, why is he taking a picture of my behind and posting it on Twitter? That, and this is one of the most gangster things about her, she goes, that is what we refer to as a creep shot.
When a conservative writer tweeted this photo of her saying, that jacket and coat don't look like a girl who struggles, she called him out for what she said was misogyny.
Would you be taking a creep shot of Steny Hoyer's behind and sharing it around? Why is there more comfort in doing that to me than there is in doing it to any other member of Congress?
And then there's the money. Just when they just got done calling her out for how rich she is because she didn't show up to D.C. in rags and tatters.
Eliminating the influence of corporate money in politics is another one of Ocasio-Cortez's signature issues. Most of her campaign funds came from small donations of $200 or less. She did accept some money from labor unions, but she refuses to take any contributions from corporate political action committees. She's angered some of her colleagues in the House by encouraging primary challenges of Democrats who accept corporate money or oppose progressive policies.
These are politically dangerous tactics that you're using. You've heard that.
Yeah.
Do you believe it?
It's absolutely risky. It requires risk to try something new, but also we know so much of what we've tried in the past hasn't worked either.
So the threat becomes, and by the way, she is one member of the House, and she's probably the most progressive member of the House, and she's working on getting the Democrats to join her, in her mission. Okay, she's one. Remember, this holding up one finger, you can't see it. One member of the House, but in the conservative world, this one member of the House who has one vote, like everyone else, all 435 members, she has one vote. This one member is going to raise taxes like crazy. And you know what's going to happen when she raises taxes and Donald Trump, after it gets passed by one Democrat in the House, nobody in the Senate, and then gets signed into law by a Republican president just because of this one member of the House. You know what's going to happen? People are going to leave the country. That's always what they say.
Question for you, Gene. There are critics who say if you do this, people will go live in other countries.
Everything has its limit. We should be sensible about it. But, you know, the truth is, if you live in New York or California right now and you make $5 million, whatever, you already have a marginal rate of 50%. You do. And a lot of the greatest innovation and startups and productivity in our country is happening. So the idea that you couldn't add, some additional marginal rate for people over, I think, as AOC proposed, $10 million, you know, again, what the exact amount is and the marginal rate, I think you would have to look at the combined effect of state and payroll taxes to make sure it didn't go too excessive. Mm-hmm. But I think the basic principle that she laid out, that you could have a higher, some type of millionaire surtax as a higher marginal rate on the most well-off without leading people to leave our country, give up all the benefits of being an American citizen, I think is unobjectionable.
75 years ago, FDR was fighting for a second Bill of Rights, and he had tons of millionaires on his back telling him, F no, no way, we will leave the country. None of this, and I mean it, this is why everyone should know their history, none of this is new.
A number of my friends who belong in the very high upper bracket have suggested to me on several occasions of late that if I am reelected president, they will have to move to some other nation because of high taxes here. Now, I will miss them very much.
Next time they say that they're just going to leave the country because how dare you try to work for the people that elected you, how effing dare you? If they say, we're going to leave the country, then you say, and you say it like this. You say, don't let the dough hit you where the good Lord split you.
On the one hand, there has been a vast majority of citizens who believe that the benefits of democracy should be extended and who are willing to pay their fair share to extend them. And on the other hand, there has been a small but powerful group which has fought the extension of these benefits because it did not want to pay a fair share of their costs.
And he points out the real problem, and this is the real problem with the money in politics. So these folks don't serve us, and for a long time, they simply have not had any interest in doing so. And when corporate Democrats and the vast majority of the United States Republican Party gets to Washington, D.C., the first thing they're thinking about is not getting you better pay. It is not getting you health care. It is not getting you affordable housing. It is not getting you clean water. It is not getting you clean air. The very, very, very first thing that they're thinking about. And remember, these clips were from 1930. Right. Our next election is in 2020. The decade after that is the 30s. These clips are 80 years old and we're still dealing somehow with the exact same crap.
We fought the World War and it cost us $25 billion in 3 years to win it. We borrowed to fight that war. A Democratic administration provided sufficient taxes to pay off the entire war debt within 10 or 15 years. Those taxes in the war days had been levied according to ability to pay. But the succeeding Republican administration did not believe in that principle, and there was a reason. They had political debt to those who sat at their elbows. To pay those political debts, They reduced the taxes of their friends in the higher bracket and left the national debt to be paid by later generations.
There is nothing, and I mean nothing, that we cannot do. The only things that we can't do are the things that we tell ourselves that we can't do, or that we shouldn't do, or this isn't the way that it's been done traditionally. Not sure if you've taken a look at all the folks that are sleeping on the sidewalk, all of the folks who have health insurance and hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in medical debt, the folks who are food insecure, and I could go on. I'm not sure if you've taken a look around, but the way that we've been doing things hasn't exactly been working out. And then there's another factor, the fact that we are just pissed at one another. Angry as can be. And we don't know why. Because see, we're not talking to one another. So the ideas that we have about one another aren't coming from the things that we are. Someone that hates me because I'm progressive doesn't know me. But they've been watching Fox, or they've been watching Limbaugh, or they've been listening to Kelly Ann Conway. And they think they know. Right? And progressives do the same thing. You know, we goddamn hate the... But why? Right? It's part of the plan. Part of the design. Because if we start talking to each other, we might realize how nuts all of this is. And how we're in the middle of it. And we're being used. And we're being traded off. Now, none of it's fair. And that we're never going to be served as long as we keep doing things the way that we've always done them. Tradition. It makes me nervous whenever I hear conservatives say tradition. Tradition, tradition, historic tradition. Times change. People change. Thoughts change. Ideas change. Patterns change. Everything changes. It's called adapting. You adapt with the times. That's what makes it work. You either evolve or you cease to exist. Thank you for being here. Again, The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 280, our official TFYCPO.podbean.com. We got a Facebook page. You should peep it. Of course, you can find us on Google Play or on the Podbean app. Individual episodes are available there. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. For as long as this show is still here, questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform, but also to entertain with our listener base. Thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. Now that I have woken you up, fists in the air. Good morning.